We've worked pretty heavily on relationships and personal interaction on the group, counteracting some of the things like groupthink, which are detrimental really to the productiveness of the group. And we know that much of what we'll cover here in the area of problem solving, you've already had. In fact, you've had it from about the third grade, because really the problem solving sequence is just a scientific method. It's the decision making method. You get it in 100 different forms starting in elementary school. But the fact is that when individuals or groups fail, it's not because they're not applying some sophisticated detail. It's because they're failing to accomplish or do or think about one of about three or four very basic things. And we want this to be fresh in your mind as you go through these different exercises, because a lot of how well you do will depend on how well you think through the different things that we have. So we want to race through that. But before I did that, what I wanted to do was just emphasize that the field exercises are the place that you can convert concepts and ideas into action. And they're designed to give you a laboratory, a place to practice what you're hearing, to try it on, to try it out. They're not just kind of recreational breaks in the action. Okay? They're designed to allow you to practice this stuff. And remember in the opening night, we said that the major breakdown of most conferences, seminars, is that you get deluged with ideas, like is happening here, and right up until the end. And then immediately you get on a plane or get in a car, or on the train or bus or whatever, you go back and you get plunged into your routine, and somebody reminds you a year later that you went to a conference. And when you begin to reflect on what good it did, how it changed or affected your life, to be honest, you'd have to say it didn't at all. Now, we rationalize that by saying, well, you get something subconsciously, unconsciously. But the fact is it doesn't do that much good. So that's why we build in the field exercises, to expose you to the concepts. Then we have the discussions to allow you to kind of discuss it, interact, the question and answer sessions with the speaker, and then go out and try it out. So remember, one of the things that we want you to do in the field exercises is take the stuff and apply it. Hopefully, we've designed the exercises so that how well you do on the exercise is a reflection of how well you apply the material. Now, if we haven't done that, then we missed it on the exercise. You can't do that perfectly. But that's why we balance the talent. That's why we went through the rather elaborate system to make sure that you all are about even, is we want the scoreboard to reflect how well you're applying what we're giving you. And we want you to feel that way as a motivation to apply it. So just that word on the field exercises. Thank you, Dave. Yes. All right. So there are a number of things that you want to apply, and then I just like to run back over some things to put in your thinking. The communication thing, you remember Bill gave you a lot of listening, communicating. You're going to do a lot of communicating. The reason we had him go first is that's the foundational block of teamwork, interaction, communication. So pull out those notes and look back over them. Pick one or two things. And really, you have to do that. You can't take the whole thing. Pick one or two things. Maybe you don't look people in the eye when you talk to them. Maybe you don't listen very well. Maybe you know that you have a tendency to speak before the other guy is finished, to cut people off when they're trying to express themselves. If you're kind of an enthusiastic person, that's a natural tendency. Well, pick one or two of those and work at that thing. This is a chance to give that a go. Okay? The other thing that I would really encourage you to do is to keep kind of a diary. When I went through squadron officer school, I had one little notebook that was a diary. And I'd briefly go back over my notes, circle something in red, and I'd write it out. It's a key lesson learned. It's something that really clicked with me. And also things that happened in our teams, things that happened on the athletic field, things that happened in the field exercises, in the discussions, that, boy, I saw something so graphically, more graphically than I'd seen it ever before. And, boy, you know, you get that inspiration, I write it out. And I've gone back to those notes years later, and that is really what I took away from squadron officer school. So I would really encourage you, before you drop dead exhausted into the sack at night, to pull out a little diary, just briefly go back through those notes, make notes to yourself about applications or points that you really saw graphically lived out on your team. Because that, you'll remember that, it'll enable you to communicate it. You'll go back and some of this stuff you'll want to communicate to your people. And you will have a whole ream of illustrations right here, right before your eyes. You'll have illustrations. And you'll forget them if you don't write them down. So that's just another word of encouragement to do that. I want to really highlight what Bob was talking about, because this is one of the key pins, the major foundational blocks of what we're trying to teach. Remember the first night we said that one of the reasons for the high attrition rate in the navigators in the middle management spot is because a guy learns in his young days as a Christian from a dominant mentor. By that I mean some teacher that he really looks up to and idolizes. And he watches that guy lead and operate. And you know the routine. You tend to mimic his personality, and we mimic his leadership style. And then you get responsibility, and you do it the way he does. And the tendency is to get a leadership style that's either mimicked from somebody else or natural to your personality. It may be authoritarian. It may be democratic. But you kind of get one that you gravitate towards for one reason or another. And then you find some passages of Scripture that seem to support that. If you're authoritarian, well, you know, you find some place where they're, you know, charging them in the battle. If you're kind of a laissez-faire guy, well, you pick up those passages in Acts where they sit around and they confer. And so what you do is you get a pattern that's kind of comfortable for you, and then you inscripturate it. You know, you know all the passages in the Bible where this is illustrated. And then you get locked into that. You set it in concrete, and that's what you do. And then as you move from responsibility to responsibility, the tendency is to make everybody change around you rather than you changing. This thing that Bob was talking about today, the importance of being able to change your leadership style to fit the task and the people you're working with, is one of the most crucial things that we have to communicate, because it's the primary reason men are failing in middle management. The fact is you start out, of course, in a grassroots sort of a ministry, and very often in a collegiate or a military ministry, you know that we can operate down in here and be looked up to, thought highly of, thought as a guy who knows where he's going. Then you begin to supervise staff, and if there's not a movement out of this quadrant, or at least a movement in this direction and up in relationships, you know that you get frustrated and the people under you get frustrated, because you're continuing to teach them, treat them like a new convert. And they're not new converts. They're growing, mature people. They're in touch with the Spirit of God. They've got visions, ideas, and so forth. Now, you can apply this in the field leadership things. Some of you will be appointed in leaders where you've got a high time constraint. There's not a lot of time to sit around and, you know, find out everybody's background and what everybody thinks. And you're going to be forced to operate here. And both as leaders and followers, it's very important to realize that there are times when your team's got to operate there. We're going to have other exercises where you have a long time. We've got one about 17, 18-hour project, which you'll have a good time. And that's lots of time to sit around and get ideas. And you'll be able to operate more up in here. Okay? So we are varying the exercises intentionally so that they're not all high task, they're not all high relationship, but we're moving you around to see if, in fact, you can vary and practice that. There'll be times when guys who are consensus leaders have got to tighten up, or you'll never get the thing done. And there are guys who are authoritarian who've got to loosen up, or you'll never finish the project. You'll lose everybody and everybody will get disinterested. Okay? This is a very important, this is one of the reasons we have the seminar, is right here. Because we, historically, have not been able to move very well. In fact, we've built convictions that we shouldn't move, based on our personality and the passages of Scripture that happen to conform to the way we think. Okay? That'd be one. And you'll be able to use this. Now, the other thing is what Bob was mentioning about the phases of a group. And you know, almost no matter who you are, you have to pass through these phases. And of course, the crucial question is, in which phase are you now? And what we like to see, and I will be very honest with you because, you know, we've got the infant and then the other two that he showed us, adolescent and adult. We found at squadron officer school, it would take a bunch of men, very similar to the way you are, 4 to 6 weeks to get and stabilize in the adult phase. That was some of the best teams. Because there's just something about putting a bunch of leaders together, you know, that there is a natural almost isolation. The vying for position business takes a little bit longer. And I'd really challenge you, you know, almost daily to ask the question, you know, where are we predominantly? Are we moving? If we're not moving, what are the barriers? And to talk about that among yourselves. You should see, I think in our group, because of the type of guys you are, you should see some substantial movement out of the infant towards the adolescent, early adult stages, you know, in 11 days. And see that consistency. Now, you'll fluctuate, as Bob mentioned, from task to task. But I would venture to say that if you deal with the things that basically you're hearing, this particular group should be able to move towards that early adult stage and identify that and talk about that. Say, where are we really and why? So this is a second thing that you can really see happening to you. I just want to get that on your mind. Okay, let's go very quickly. Let me mention two other things. Several guys have mentioned that the stuff is coming so fast that we can't absorb it. And we're going to loosen up. We're going to pull out one of the field exercises and open up one or maybe two of the class sessions for you. Either sleep if you need to. But I appreciate that feedback. A number of guys have given it. And please feel free to do that. Because it's first time through and we're learning. So you guys help us on this. So we're going to open that up. I want you to know that there's some relief insight, and we'll let you know probably tomorrow morning exactly which periods will open up for you. Any other comments or things that you'd like to have at it? Is everybody there? Jim?
Mm-hmm. Okay, we don't want to fluctuate in the situation with all four of those types.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're talking about the leadership style slide?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's going to be one, and I think this is, of course, the point of Fiedler's model contingency thing, is there'll be one of those where you predominantly operate, where you're most comfortable. And probably it would be good to fit yourself into a job where that is productive. And I think the point, of course, of this one that Bob was making is this is more a day-to-day, situation-by-situation thing where you have to make some adjustments. Right. Any other comments? Yeah, Don?
My concept was I thought we needed to change. This was one of the problems. We needed to be pressed to change.
No, is your comment... No, say it again. Yes.
One of the problems we've had at management.
Yes.
They don't change. They come up on one thing and then they don't make any adjustments. Later on, it changes the situation.
Yes. Bob, you want to comment on that? You might just clarify it because I may have muddied the water.
No, I don't think it did, but I think we do need to be willing to change and to make modifications in our behavior and to try out new things. That's one of the good deals in having a situation like this. When we do have the field exercise, if you tend to find yourself being more task-oriented, try out some of the relationship things and relationship behaviors as an experiment to see how it feels, to see what kind of new things, and where you make mistakes. Because this is the place to make a mistake, if you're going to make one. And then go back and say, okay, I still need some more work on that. And maybe I need to sit down with somebody who's even my peers or my subordinates in the ministry and say, now, how about you give me some feedback? Mm-hmm. I want to try some different things and see if I can improve in what I'm trying to do. And I need you to tell me how it's coming across.
Mm-hmm. Very good. A number of guys have also mentioned the fact that in competition, there's a tendency if we could back off of the competition a little bit, then we could work on the personal relationships a little easier. And that's true, but it's unrealistic. We put the competition in to try to simulate what you have in real life. Basically, what we're saying is, you know, if I could take the rewards and the punishments out of real life, it would be easier for me to work on relationships. It's like guys at seminary say they overload us at seminary. They kill us. I don't have time for my wife. I don't have time for my kids. What he's saying is I want to get A's. And I can't get A's easy at seminary and pay attention to my wife and kids. And of course, what he's poking against is what we turn around and say, well, why don't you take a C? Well, because that injures my self-esteem. I have to put up with the fact that somebody thinks that I'm only average, and I can't stand to do that. In fact, I can't stand it so much that I'll sacrifice my wife and kids to prevent it from happening. I'm going to get that A. And really the point is, you know, as a C is probably the cheapest obedience will ever come. And yet guys won't pay that. And the same way here, we put in the competitive edge so that, you know, you feel the same sorts of pressures that you do in real life. So basically, you may have to buy some cost in that to build relationships if you think it's worth it. Okay, so I just want to speak to that because, yeah, we could lighten it up. That's not realistic. Any other comments or anything else you'd like to share? Let's go into problem solving, and I'll just go through this very quickly because it is, we just stole this straight from the Air Force. It's amoral. You find it in the scriptures. It's, you know, it's a proven way to solve problems. Can everybody see this? Kind of? No? All right. Let me cock it around a little bit and see if you can see that. I'll chat about it. Okay, problem solving. Most of the exercises we do are designed to get you as a team to go through this process of problem solving. And as you can see, it's just five simple steps. This is the decision-making process. It's a scientific method. It's what we use in mathematics. It's what they use in management. We call it problem solving here. It's you can find it in the scriptures. It just works. You know, it's like gravity. The first step, of course, as you can see on there, is to recognize the problem. Identify it, analyze it, limit it, state it. Very, very important. I heard somebody, and I don't remember who it was. I wish I had it on tape because a guy who was out here working this escape thing said the trouble with our team is we never crystallized the problem. The problem was simple. Find the gate and four names of guys to go. And a lot of their information shuffling had to do with, you know, who had the disguise and who had the money and so forth. And they said, if we'd have spent time to crystallize the problem, we could have solved it very quickly. But we didn't. So that's a very important thing. A classic example, my family background, training, and trade is military. And so a lot of my examples come from the military. But a classic example of this in military history is MacArthur's island hopping strategy in World War II. His objective was not to annihilate the Japanese army. Neither was it to liberate all the land that they had captured. It was to gain the unconditional surrender of the imperial government. And so if there was an island that didn't contribute to that, he'd say, let them have it. And that's what we'll go to the next one. Classic example of that. So identify it. This is, say for example, in the, I think I use the example here of the escape thing. If you identify it, you get the general idea. We're trying to break some guys out of the prison here. Analyze it. That's where you read the rules and you find out now exactly how are we supposed to go about that. Well, there's clues spread around. You limit it. This is what that guy who was commenting said we never did. Because the limit of the problem was find the gate and four names of guys to go. If you didn't limit it, it would still be kind of a general thing and you'd use a lot of information you didn't need. And then get a tentative statement of it so at least you know what you're doing. What you're doing. You know, Campus Crusade, my wife is a Crusade staff, and I think one of their real strengths is Bill Bright has a very, very clear recognition of the problem that his team has been called to solve. He has very simple. He wants to communicate the gospel to everybody by 1980. Very simple, very clear. That's why Lauren worked on this FOM thing for 2 years, trying to crystallize what is the problem God has assigned us to work on. Very valuable. Okay, recognize the problem. The second one is gather the facts. You'll see this a lot in the exercises in the form of the rules. That's why we give you a lot of information, some of which is helpful, some of which is not particularly helpful, and that's about as real life as you can get. If you remember, the NASA problem is a classic example of the need to do this. Factual information. You had to find out where was the moon craft that you were supposed to rendezvous with. Well, it was on the bright side. Where were you? You were 200 miles away. Okay? Now, two teams had difficulty figuring out whether they were on the dark or the light side. Now, if the rendezvous point is on the light side and you're 200 miles from the rendezvous point, probably, where are you? Light side. That's probably. That's right. And now that gets down to the second one, which is the assumptions. And I don't want to criticize you. Incidentally, when I went through it, I didn't get that either. But I went back and I began to study that and I said, well, you know, things don't change a lot in 200 miles. It certainly doesn't go from light to dead black in 200 miles. Okay? Okay. So anyway, you want to get the facts. And that's where it was helpful to figure out, well, is there oxygen on the moon? Is there a magnetic field? Are there poles on the moon? Things like that. Okay? Then you need to make some assumptions. And this is a very frustrating thing. And I went back and I felt for, I think it was Dave Seaver. It was you all, wasn't it, that brought this up. And boy, I felt for you guys because I was thinking, you know, they did everything right. They were thinking right. They thought well. It's just that somehow the assumptions got confused and it really wasn't their fault so much. But they did everything right and they came in last. And nothing is more frustrating, as you know, to do everything right. And then when the public acclaim comes or the newspapers covered or whatever, to look like an idiot. Because it looks like you did everything wrong. And what you feel want to jump up and down and scream is, but I did it right. I'm not as dumb as this looks. And that's frustrating. That's right. But you know, real life is you've got to make assumptions. One thing that's pretty common is you never have all the information you need. And sometimes, so you've got to learn, you know, that's part of the game. Formulate criteria. This is where basically what you're doing is you're saying what sorts of solutions are acceptable? How much are we willing to pay in terms of time, money, and energy? And then define things. You know, we had a stellar map, for example. What on earth is a stellar map? You know, you've got to find somebody who knows what that is as an illustration. Okay? So you recognize the problem, then you've got to get your facts straight. And you know, if you don't take time to do this, very often, recognize the problem, move right down to here, and we do get in a lot of trouble. I know, and you probably know of a number of campuses, for example, where the guy goes in, gets his vision, and launches, and the way he finds out the campus rules is with a note to show up at the dean's desk. You know, and then the work is set back about 3 years because you've got to dig out of the hole that you got yourself into because you never found out what the rules are. I've seen that in the military. You know, where we'll come onto a base and go house to house evangelism, somebody will complain, and we never really took time to find out what the rules are. This is very a classic military example. Many of you may have seen the movie Midway, when the Japanese were moving towards Midway, and they didn't know where the American fleet was. They figured they were still hovering around Pearl Harbor, recoiling from the attack just several months earlier. But Admiral Halsey was moving out into the Pacific. And, of course, his carrier task force was covered by clouds. The Japanese task force spotted a few of his ships, sent all their airplanes after a few ships, came back and landed empty, out of bombs, and about that time, Halsey's force appears in the clearing, and they caught the Japanese with their planes on the deck because they didn't have the information. They had false assumptions. They didn't have the facts at bad intelligence. Okay, that's a military example. List all the possible solutions. This is, particularly for a choleric bunch like us, an action group, our tendency is to get one idea and go with it. Anybody got an idea? We'll go with that. And in a time-constrained situation, that's not bad. But in a ministry situation, where most of us live, that's very bad. Because it's almost a sure bet that you could come up with a much better solution, a much better plan, if you took the time to just sit there and stare across the table at each other and say, we want more ideas. Get them all on the table. Practically, the way you do this is you brainstorm. Everything goes, and withhold judgment. Let everybody get all their ideas. You know, you're doing campus evangelism. So, well, let's fly over and drop leaflets. Great. You know, let's bring in a Billy Graham movie. Let's bring in Billy Graham. You know, let's put on a radio show. Let's have a running song fest. We'll provide the singers. You know, a number of things like that. And it's amazing what you can come up with if you'll merely give the guys and the team an opportunity. How do we build unity? Well, let's have a baseball team. Let's play basketball. Let's join the intramural league in our college. So forth. Whatever the question is, it's very, very valuable to list as many different sorts of solutions to the problem as you can. Get them all out on the table. I imagine a number of you have already seen this in both the escape and the NASA exercise, maybe even in volleyball. Somebody will have a plan and say, okay, we'll go with that. Well, sit around and listen a little bit longer. And you'll find that there are a number of approaches, some of which are significantly better than the first one you heard. It's really very valuable, but as activists, we tend to get one and lock onto it and go. Classic example of this, I was thinking when about two-thirds of the way through the Vietnamese conflict, I think it would have been in 71, 72, we had a tremendous morale problem both in the U.S. and, of course, overseas over the MIA POW issue. Trying to figure out, now, how can we alleviate this? What can we do about this? And the guy said, well, you know, maybe we can negotiate at Paris. Maybe we can buy some of them back. Maybe we can trade some of them back. Maybe we ought to stop flying up there so no more guys get shot down, nobody gets captured. Well, some idiot suggested the idea, why don't we go get them back? Go get them back. Can't go get them back. They're all North Vietnam. Impossible to go get them back. They thought about that. Sure enough, it was about the 20th thing down on the list. It's like, go get them back. Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea to alleviate it. And so they initiated what's called the raid on Santé. And it turned out to be quite an operation. They sent in several choppers and, of course, a special army team. Basically, the plan was to go get them back. They just took them right up there in North Vietnam, plunked these guys down on the roofs of the compound, and they were going to break those guys out and bring them back. Unfortunately, nobody was in the prison. North Vietnamese moved them. Fortunately, the reaction was even better than getting back 50 guys. It forced the Vietnamese to pull all the guys into the Hanoi Hilton. For the first time in the war, they were all together, and it forced the Vietnamese to loosen up. The guys got put in large pens rather than solitary confinement. So it had results. But that's an illustration of something that unless they'd have sat around for a long time, chances are nobody would have said, let's go get them back. I mean, that was just ridiculous. Okay. Test the solutions. This is really where you use your criteria. And, you know, for example, you might have an evangelistic thrust and say, okay, we've got $2,000. We've got a team of 20 people. We can't spend more money than that. We can't use more than half the time of these people. And so what you do is you take the list of possible ones and you begin to narrow the field until you get one or two that you're willing to pay the cost on. Then select the one that seems the best and do it. Now that's the problem-solving sequence. And in each of your team rooms, this is a duplicate of this. Put it up on your wall. Some of you have already done that, I noticed. Put it up on your wall. Look at that thing. Because it is amazing. Like I said, the reason that people, individuals and teams fail is not because they forgot some minor detail. It's because they've left out a major pillar in the process. One of these. Okay? And all we want to do is to not teach you the fine details. We just want you to go through this process about 25 times between now and Tuesday night. Okay? That's it. Now, when you transfer problem solving in general to teamwork with a group of people specifically, it's where we get the science we call management. And management is merely problem solving with a group of people. It may be two, it may be 2,000, it may be 200,000. And management, that's about all it is. That's, you know, it's gotten to be a nasty word because we associate it with impersonal treatment of people, with cold American Westernism. But you see examples of it throughout the Scriptures. It's merely logical, common sense, sound judgment sort of ways of proceeding. I wouldn't say that these are all biblical universals, and we go round and round on that. I really don't think that particular question is really relevant. It's like, you know, how do you get from the top of the hill to the bottom of the hill? Well, there's not a verse that tells you to walk down the hill, but it's a pretty good idea. Okay? Okay. Planning. Scriptures happen to have a lot to say about planning. Proverbs 21:5, I think, something like that, talks about the importance of planning, the destructiveness of hastiness. And you can see the steps there. Again, there's a copy of this in your seminar room, so you don't have to scramble to copy it down. Basically, planning is just the problem-solving sequence. If you compare this with what's on there, you find that they're very, very similar. Planning. There's some outstanding scriptural examples of this. When Jesus, of course, was in Mark 1, when he was having a magnificent ministry in Capernaum, people, of course, flocking to him. He went off, spent a night in prayer to get the plan clearly from God. Peter came to him the next morning and said, "Come, Lord, you know there are thousands here waiting." And he says, "No, we can't, because my objective is to preach the gospel throughout Israel." And he embarked, he had a plan. And so it said he went from village to village to fulfill the objective he'd been given. You see this tremendously in the life of David when he assembled all the materials for David or for Solomon to build a temple. He said, he gave him an extensive plan. So to think ahead is not bad. I appreciate what Tom Crompton shared with me when I was in Tacoma. He made the comment that the farther ahead that we think, the more control we give the Holy Spirit in our ministry. I thought, boy, now that is almost counter to the free spirit movement, you know, let the spirit lead, which means don't think at all. But his point was well taken. The farther ahead you think, the less emotional your decisions are, the more the Spirit of God has an opportunity to really work on you to get His plan rather than your impulse into effect. The next step, of course, is organizing. And as you know, the classic illustration of that in the Scriptures is Exodus 18, when Moses was doing all the judging himself. And Jethro straightened him out, gave him some criteria by which to select men. And it says, the work was done. The people went home satisfied. Very, very important. You read Nehemiah, and it's shot through with organization. Very, very clever organization. Very, very clever. The way that he assigned the tasks and where he placed the men and where he placed their families with respect to where they were building. He organized the work and motivated it very well. The two key things, of course, of motivation are to divide the workload. I'm going to jump up and down because you will notice that the next field exercise is called, anybody know? Organizational ordeal. Okay, so everybody jab your buddy next to you because this one is going to measure organizational ability. Okay, give you a big tip on that. But the thing is to divide that workload. And you know, I've done it. Boy, in fact, I'm in the middle of it. You know, where I know that if I didn't have Frank Wicks and I didn't have Harv McGee and Bob Stevens, you know, we would be behind the power curve much farther than we are now. And they've just really taken a good share of the load in this thing. What you want to do, of course, is figure out what are similar sorts of things. Divide that up and assign it to people who are good at, you know, the types of things I need doing. The whole concept of the body in the New Testament is a graphic illustration of the need to divide the workload, and not only to divide it, but to give it to people who are strong in the areas that relate to the work. If you've got an administrator, give it to an administrator. The objective of our disciple-making process is not to frustrate people or to convince them that they can do nothing well, thereby making them dependent for life on our leadership. It's to help them find out what they do well, get them doing it, and tell them to become the best in the world at it. And basically that's organization. Dividing the workload, matching people with the tasks. Okay, the next step, of course, is coordination. And you'll experience this a number of times, the importance of maintaining. Of course, this is where in the management process they put the maintenance of human relationships and the maintenance of a unified effort. This is where communication during the task is important. If you change the plan, you've got to let everybody know. If there's something, you know, we'll give instructions. You'll notice we'll primarily give our instructions to the team captains, to the leader of the exercise, primarily because we don't want to do your coordination for you. He can hold it or dispense it as he wants. But coordination is important, and we'll get into a number of exercises later where you've got to keep each other informed as to how the progress is going. There'll be a number of interesting ones on that. Directing talks about, directing is a bad word in Christian circles, simply because it has that authoritarian ring to it. But the fact is one of the primary responsibilities of a leader is to initiate the action. You know full well your own tendency, and mine too, to sit around and think, and the greatest waste of time, as Doss used to say, is the time getting started. And there's some beautiful illustrations of this in the scriptures where David is charging Solomon. He says, okay, we've planned it, we've organized it, everybody knows what to do it, now be strong and do it. Do not sit around on your can, do it. Get the thing done. Same thing, you see this a lot in the life of Ezra and Nehemiah, where the people bog down and get discouraged and fiddle around, and they're basically they're telling them to get on with it. And there's some steps in there that you can kind of see. Then, of course, controlling. Again, this is basically it's built on the Louis Allen, the AMA, however you want to call this. But really, you can see in controlling, what we're talking about is what Doug is talking about. We use the word, and I think it's better, sustaining. The idea being that you not only initiate, which is about 5% of it, but it's that thing that Prof. Hendricks was talking about, keeping the team moving in the face of barriers, problems, adverse circumstances. Again, Nehemiah and Ezra are rich in the area of sustaining. A number of times, the temple gets stopped. The wall gets stopped. There are certain things, and they have to move in and get the thing going again, or if they just, let's say, ferret, it'll never make it. The people will just stop. So these are the basic functions, and again, they're very simple. There are just five of them. We've designed the exercises to allow you to go through the problem solving and the management sequence over and over again until you, because really that's the way you learn it. You don't learn it by reading short statements about it or long statements about it in thick textbooks, but you'll learn it by doing. So that is the problem solving. Remember, the objectives of the Institute are to teach you to accomplish tasks. These are the basic tools we're going to give you in task accomplishment. And I think if you apply the fundamentals, don't rush through. If you start skipping steps, that's where things fall through the cracks. But these are the basic tools that we'll give you to accomplish tasks. And remember, the other is to develop unity, to sustain unity from both the position of a leader and a team member on a working team. Okay? So that's what this is all about. Any questions on either of these two things? Need clarification? Anything? Is there anything you'd like to ask Bob Linden? Because, boy, he really had to fly. Sing on that? All righty. Why don't we stretch? And let's see if we could, what time is the next event? 2:15. Okay. Free to stretch until 2:15. Please, again, this is going to be extensive. It'll take us the whole time to do it. So take a break, wander around, go get a nap or something. 2:15 back here for the organizational ordeal.